Hi, Women of Strength. Before we jump into today's episode, I just wanted to share something that's really close to my heart. If you're planning a VBAC or even just starting to think about one, you don't have to piece everything together on your own. You don't have to find every blog or hunt down a specific podcast episode. The VBAC Link Parent Prep Course was created by our founders, Julie and Megan, who are doulas and VBAC moms themselves. I actually took it when I was preparing for my own VBAC, long before I was a host of the podcast, just as a mom who needed clarity, confidence, and evidence-based information. So I can say, from a personal standpoint, that I know you'll love it. We also have a VBAC birth plan guidebook with a drag and drop template, and that's the exact template I used for my own VBAC birth. It made communicating with my care team so much more smooth. So if you're looking for practical, supportive VBAC prep from people who truly get it, you can find both the course and the guidebook at thevbaclink.com. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Happy Wednesday, Women of Strength. I am your host, Paige, and joined by my co-host, Lily. You are listening to the VBAC Link podcast. We are also joined today by one of our favorite guests. We had her on the podcast before, back in 2022. It is Dr. Hazel Keetle. And back then, Megan was the host in that episode. I was behind the scenes transcribing Hazel's episode, and I absolutely fell in love with everything they talked about. It was where some of the seeds for maternal assisted cesarean were first planted. They briefly discussed that. We talked about her book, Birth After Cesarean, and she now has a new book that we are going to talk about birth after cesarean, the clinician's guide to birth after cesarean. So welcome back, Hazel.
Well, thank you for having me. I love being on here.
We're so happy and so excited to get into what you talked about in this book. It is so rich and full of wonderful things. I encourage any birth workers and even parents to read it. There's so much value within what you talk about. So after our intro, we will get into it.
Hi, I'm Lily.
And I'm Paige. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast.
We're moms and doulas who know firsthand that birth after cesarean isn't always straightforward. I'm a miscarriage and ectopic mom who went on to have a hospital water birth VBAC.
And I've had two CBACs and a planned maternal assisted cesarean.
Our experiences may be different, but our mission is the same: to make birth after cesarean better.
On this podcast, you'll hear powerful stories of VBACs, repeat cesareans, and CBACs from women around the world.
We'll also bring in expert insight, practical tools, and encouragement to help you feel informed and supported as you plan your next birth.
Whether you're preparing for a VBAC, choosing a repeat cesarean, or simply exploring your options, this space is for you.
Because every story matters, and we're here to remind you that you've got options, you've got support, and you're never alone.
The VBAC Link is storytelling by nature. The stories on this podcast do not represent a universally best or safest option for everyone.
This podcast is intended to encourage and inform. It does not replace individualized advice from a qualified medical provider.
Okay, welcome back. I will read Dr. Hazel Keetle's bio, and then we will get into talking to her about some of the things that she mentions in her book. Dr. Hazel Keetle is a senior lecturer of midwifery and director of academic midwifery programs at the School of Nursing and Midwifery, Western Sydney University. Hazel has experience as a clinician in nursing and midwifery and as an educator and researcher. Her research interests are vaginal birth after cesarean, birth trauma, and maternity experiences. Hazel is the author of book Birth After Cesarean, Your Journey to a Better Birth, and A Clinician's Guide to Better Birth After Cesarean, which are based on her PhD findings. Hazel is also the lead researcher on the largest Australian maternity experiences survey, the Birth Experience Study, and the Best International Collaboration. So, Hazel, as I was reading your book, I noticed you mentioned, and also listening to podcasts that you've been on, that you got your master's and your PhD while you had two young children. Is this correct?
Yeah, well, actually, when I was doing my master's, all five were at home. So when I married my husband, he came with three bonus children that lived at home with us. And so, yeah, we had all of them at that point. And then in my PhD, there was the older ones were starting to leave home. So, yeah, they were, and my youngest were kind of teenagers by that point, but certainly a very busy mum, working and managing a very neurodiverse household as well. Everybody in our household has in your diversity. So it's, yeah, it's a big challenging mess.
So we are in the thick of little ones. I have 4 little ones, 9 and under. Lily has 2 little ones. So how did you do it?
How did I do it? Not very easily, but I think it was my passion. I really fell in love with doing research. And then research kind of became what I did anyway as my job. So I've always worked. I've only ever maybe gone part-time when the kids were very little. But even then, they were used to having an on-call mum because I was a privately practicing midwife or a group practice midwife, which is having your own caseload in a hospital. So they were used to me either being away at shifts or being on call and having to disappear. Like mum might be there at bedtime, but not there in the morning because I've gone off to a birth. So they were very used to my life of being a midwife. We lived in a regional or rural area actually for quite a lot of that time. And sometimes women would just turn up at my household as well. So they're pregnant and they're having an appointment and I'm kicking the kids out of the lounge room so that I can listen to the baby. So they were very much, me being a midwife was very much part of their life. And I think the difference with the research was I could actually do that from home a lot of the time. So I was able to be around and they all know that I'm just working on the computer.
You juggle it. It's so amazing. Yeah, we take inspiration. Do what you have to do. Exactly. So in our previous episode, we learned more about your birth stories. Hazel got into that. We talked about just in general what birth and different models of care you have over there in Australia. And for reference, for listeners who aren't familiar, Hazel, yes, is located in Australia. Lily is over in Colorado. And then I'm here in South Korea. So touching all parts of the world today. We also talked about within your research, you go into not just the quantitative, which are the numbers, but you really look into the qualitative and experience based, which I really, really think is fantastic. But for women who are preparing for their birth, wanting to have evidence-based care, wanting to get into research, but don't have a research background, what do you say to them when it feels a little overwhelming?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the initial book, the first book, was because we call it translation to evidence in research. The ability to be able to translate the tricky stuff that we do and maybe the language that we use into language that most people could read so that it actually means something to them. And that's something I take on, I guess, very seriously because I think it's no point just being in these journal articles that, you know, some people will read and not many people will get access to. It really needs to be in the hands. So I think it's trusting people that can actually do that work for you and look at the research, but then put it in a way that they can understand. And I hope that that's what I did in both books, actually, because in the second book, aiming that at clinicians, they learn about evidence-based research, but then they've got to go out to the real world and they forget sometimes how to read that research again. So I didn't change my language style much between one and the other because it's got to be in really plain English language that people can understand. So I think it's, if you want to learn about the evidence, sure, go and read the articles, that's fine. But also look for resources that can actually translate that into, I guess, more plain language or more understanding language. And that's certainly one of the things that I love to do.
And Hazel, how do you blend, let's say you have a mama in care who is looking at research and she's wanting to come to her provider with this research. How do you blend that with the attitude that some providers can have of like, well, Google's not a doctor program. Google's not a midwifery program. How do you get clinicians to understand the balance of their clients coming in potentially with research that they've done? And maybe it is quality research. What does that look like in practice?
Well, actually, the quality research is really easy to get because so many of our papers are now open access. So you don't have to rely on a university account or hospital account to get access to it. It's just knowing how to get that. And Google Scholar is then your friend rather than Google, but you're a Google Scholar, and that's where you'll get those peer-reviewed. But I've had many women say that they will just take my first book and they'll put that on the desk and say, this is what Hazel says. And then you can't really argue it because it is being written by a researcher who's actually done most of, or, you know, a lot of the research that I'm talking about. But I think do it anyway, because clinicians often think that they're up to date with research and they may or may not be. And one of the things I educate our student midwives, because I run the programs for student midwives here at our university, but also when I speak to, I've done workshops in three different countries on how to, how for clinicians to support women having a better birth after cesarean. And I say to them, you can't tell them to not go to Google, because when you say to somebody they can't go to Google, you're saying a few different things. One, you're saying that you don't think they're smart enough to be able to figure out what's true and what's not true. And there's a lot of misinformation on any topic. There's misinformation, right? And two, you're also saying to, you're also shutting a door. So if a woman, if you say to a woman, look, this test is going to happen next week or your next appointment, but don't Google it, everything's fine, just do what I tell you to do. You know, by the time they've got on public transport or they're in the car, before they drive away, they're going to Google it, because that's what we all do. It's what you do when you go to the doctors or see a nurse or a midwife. It's what I do. So by then saying you can't do it, what happens is the woman might find something on Google and it might be a little bit strange what it's suggesting. And she might follow that advice, but you're never going to know as the clinician, because she's not going to come back and say, oh, look, I read this thing and I'm not too sure about it, because you said don't go to Google. So people aren't going to fess up to doing something that they're not told to do. And that's actually against what we should be doing as clinicians, which is providing public health and providing education. It's much better to say, look, you're bound to go on Google. We all do. However, here are some really good sites for you to get started on. And so I suggest you go to this one and this one. They're great sites, evidence-based information. But, you know, you might go down a rabbit hole of information. Whatever you do, just bring that information next time and let's have a chat about it, because there can be misinformation. There can be a variety of different resources. Let's have a conversation, because I love it when women go and do this, because I get to learn more as well. And to make it that two-way open, then they might come back and say, well, what about this one? What do you reckon? And then you can use your knowledge and skills to say why that's not something to trust. And in that way, you've educated them on not only the topic, but how to critique what's available online as well.
I love that. That makes me think of two things. Like, number one, the relationship piece that you talk about. In our other episode, you also talk about your four pillars of better birth after cesarean, and relationship is, something you talk a lot about. And then also it makes me think too, that time that encourage that insinuates, I'm going to give you that time to have that discussion, which in many models of care, that fragmented care, oftentimes you don't have that continuing relationship and that continuing discussion.
So that's true, because that is a challenge. If you're only seeing the woman for the one time, I've often had, you know, doctors say to me, I feel like I've got to cram everything into that appointment. And it's just a series of, I've got to do this, this, and this, because I might not see them again. And what if I miss something? And it becomes all about the risk. But then if you just add in there and don't go on Google, then that just stops any two-way conversation and learning on both sides. Even if they're going to see somebody different next time, they're probably going to be told that again and again and again. And they'll just build up their own wealth of knowledge. And then actually that can cause distrust, because what they can find might be different to what they're being told by different people throughout the maternity care system. And what we really need is much better understanding of the information that's online and the information that clinicians know. And rather than saying it's one or the other, it's actually both. And we can help with both information. I've actually got a PhD student starting next year, which I'm really excited about. And she's really going to do a deep dive into the information that women find online and how that actually influences their decision. And that includes podcasts.
I love it. Well, and speaking of, thank you again for your shout out in your book to us. There are a couple of things in your book that I was like, oh, and that was one of them. And I'm like, that's us. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Like, I honestly think podcasts are so helpful to women, and especially podcasts like yourself. You balance the evidence and the storytelling, and that's so important because that's how I balance my books, right? It's got the storytelling and the evidence. And that's how our brains work. We like all the numbers, but we want to be able to relate to somebody that we can relate to and go, okay, well, I can see how this will work for me. So yeah, I tell clinicians to go online and listen to podcasts, especially if they don't really understand why, like, why do a VBAC in the first place? I just don't get it. And they just tell women, just book an elective cesarean. It's much easier for you. And vaginal birth doesn't matter. And that's so against what many, many women feel. So I tell them to go and listen as well. And I mean, don't be judgmental. Just listen to why it was important for that woman. And if you can figure out her why, then you've learned something.
Yeah. I just love that you're bringing humanity back to care. I think that that matters so, 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 so much, Hazel. And I just, like, bravo to you, truly. It's world changing. It really is.
Well, look, yeah. I love the balance of both. And that's the quantitative and the qualitative, like you were saying earlier, you know, the numbers plus the stories. And the numbers don't mean anything unless we look at the stories. You know, we could come up with a brand new intervention. So like say like a new pill and it's going to have this kind of outcome for people. And we think as researchers, that's a better outcome. But if you never actually asked women what it was like to have that outcome or, you know, they what's the point? You might find that they hated it and the side effects were way too big or it was too expensive or whatever it was, that there was something that women didn't like it. You didn't get bothered to get their experiences. And now this is going to impact care and it's their care. And to be fair, we can see this with induction of labor right now. We pushed out a big study that potentially said the outcomes were better without actually looking at the amount of women that wouldn't stay in that trial. They did not want to be induced. They left that side and they never asked them why. And we have, like we've published a couple of papers now looking at women's experiences of induction of labor and they don't like it. And they don't want to do it next time. But that wasn't taken into consideration when they changed all of these policies just because of that one study.
Yeah, that's definitely an important part of research and maybe even sometimes the limitation when women want to hold so tightly onto numbers and make their decisions based on, oh, there's this risk or my doctor's telling me about all the VBAC risks. And then so I should just choose a cesarean. But there's risk everywhere and with everything. And even as you were talking about with your stories and you got pregnant 5 months, I think, after you had your cesarean.
4 months. Four months.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess what would you say to women who truly believe that they are going to be in that small percentage of catastrophic outcomes?
Look, I get many women contact me online and or by email, and they'll say that they've got this certain thing. So it might be a particular type of scar, for example, that isn't a lower segment, you know, like, and there's just a blanket term of special scars, I think, for that works best. Or it could be that they're a short interpregnancy interval or that they've got more than one cesarean, and they'll come and say, can I have a VBAC? And I'm like, it's never for any of us to say whether or not you can or you cannot. Sometimes we won't even know what your uterine rupture risk is. And I recently did a workshop over the other side of Australia in Perth. And I asked them all what they want to learn beforehand. And some of them wanted to know the specific uterine rupture rate for some of these specific issues.
Yes.
And I said, well, go and run the study to find that out then, because we don't have that information. We've got some population data. We have, and they give us a uterine rupture rate of that particular study. So women can't type in to an app and say, this is what's wrong with me. This is what's going to be uterine rupture rate. Nothing can 100% equal, like nothing can cause 100% chance of having a uterine rupture rate. It may increase from what we're used to, which is maybe less than 0.5, right? So we're used to it very small and it may increase. So when I looked at my short interpregnancy interval, that was based on research that came out in 2007, which was actually the year I had my cesarean. So it was very current. And that found that the uterine rupture rate for short interpregnancy interval, which was less than 6 months, and mine was 4 months. So less than 6 months from having a cesarean to conception, not birth, conception, that less than 6 months meant they had from that study, which wasn't a massive study, was a 2.7% uterine rupture rate. Now, that seemed huge when I'd read all these studies that said 0 point something, right? 2.7 seemed huge. But then when you put that in when you flip it and it's more than 97% absolutely fine, then you're like, oh, okay, all right, it's actually, it was a risk I was happy with. And that's the point. It's got to be a risk that the woman is happy with doing. And sometimes we can't just make that up. Like, we can't just come up and say, I get this all the time. People say, the doctor said I've got a 10% chance of having uterine rupture. And I'm like, but what have they based that on? What's that? We don't have that kind of science. Like, have they got like a special ball in front of them? And they can then like tell you exactly what's going to happen in the future. And they have one path that tells you uterine rupture. Like, we don't have that. We only have some, there could be some increases and it could be around about this, but we don't actually know. And that's the challenge, because then that brings in uncertainty, and some people don't like uncertainty, especially risk-based medicine. They don't like that uncertainty. It's much easier to, for their risk perception, to suggest a repeat cesarean. However, you're right. They do not then mention what the risks are of repeat cesarean. And we're now seeing this more because we are having more cesareans and more women having repeat cesareans. And I put this up on I presented at a conference a couple of months ago to all doctors and lawyers. And I put this on a slide. You know, I had the uterine rupture risk and perineal tearing risk under VBAC. But under cesarean, there was a much, much longer list of things that were going to happen or could happen, right? Things that the risk factor. And one of my arguments to them was, you do not give balanced information. Because there are many women that I've interviewed and surveyed over the years that know exactly about VBAC, about the VBAC risks, and know nothing about the repeat cesarean risk. So you're actually not giving enough information for a woman to make informed consent. And that's something we need to change.
Totally. How do you navigate? Because we get very similar questions, as I'm sure you can imagine. Just I do a Q&A every week, and I consistently get a like, here's my birth history. What are my odds of having a VBAC? What's my success rate? And I'm consistently telling folks about exactly what you just said. We don't have a specific study on this, like these tiny little details of your birth story. And people often come back with like, well, that's so frustrating that we don't have research about it. And I agree, it's frustrating. But how do we approach looking at research through a lens of, we look at research really like in a broad population. We want a quality study. We don't just want a research study of three people that had this unique circumstance, and then it makes a conclusion for all people. So how do you navigate like research being a really hard thing, A, in pregnancy, then niche it down to VBAC, then niche it down to these tiny little details? How do you give people really great care in the unknown, in the like, the answer is I don't know, and we have to walk in open-handed? What's your advice to those folks that find that like they want this tight fist so much to data that may not exist for them or their circumstances?
Well, that's the coming from the viewpoint that planning a VBAC is an illness, right? That having getting pregnant and going through pregnancy and then having a baby is an illness, that there's stuff that is really risky and that needs managed, compared to dancing in the gray zone that my beautiful professor Hannah Darling is known for saying, dancing in that gray zone of, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. We still do not, like it's 2025, right? We still do not know exactly what causes labor to start.
Yeah,
we do not know. We know it's something to do with the woman and her hormones. It's something to do with the baby and maybe the positioning. And then the rest is, who knows? And for people of faith, they may say that's the faith part, right? And for people who don't have faith, they might just say, well, that's just, we just don't know. But that's the unknown part. We don't know. And this is one of the big differences, I believe, between obstetrics and midwifery. Because for midwifery, we love that gray zone, right? Give us that gray zone. We'll happily dance in it naked all night. Like, we are just used to it. It is unknown. You don't know it, when your labor is going to start. You don't know what it's going to be like. You don't know how you're going to manage X, Y, and Z. But as midwives, they are trained to spot deviations from this lovely normality. And then to go, okay, this is when we might need some extra support, or this is where we might need to transfer in, or this is when we need to, you know, give you some fluids. That's what the midwives is there for. But fundamentally, they completely and utterly believe that you cannot predict anything, but you can hold the woman's hand and help her through that journey and build her up to be able to cope with the craziness of labor and birth. And I think VBAC is the ultimate barometer of this, right? Because on one side, you've got a planned repeat cesarean. On the other, you've got, well, let's welcome the unknown. And midwives love caring for women in that unknown part. And I think in a very medicalized model, VBAC can be very challenging. And there's even, because I was talking about uterine rupture risk, and you mentioned, Lily, the probability of having a VBAC. And they have tried to design an app for that, and it is notoriously...
It's a mess.
Women blaming women, right? Like it's, or doctors blaming women for their bodies, that their bodies are at fault. When actually there's, we know that where you birth and who you birth with, like the model of care, mm-hmm. has more of an influence on what type of birth you will have than anything that you put in that VBAC calculator. It has been, like, actually, it was one of the chapters I enjoyed writing the most in the second book, was debunking that VBAC calculator, because based on, and you know, Professor Grobman is an amazing researcher, and I try and get people into their head of maybe the researchers that wrote it. It makes sense from a male perspective, right? To try, and an obstetric perspective, to try and figure out who's going to have one and who's not. Like it wants to make sense in that very controlled world of, well, I want to know, what was it, a repetitive reason for you know, why you had a cesarean last time? What was your age? What was your BMI? What was your ethnicity? Although, thank the Lord, they took that out thanks to the amazing Dr. Nicholas Rabashkin. And, you know, these other factors, to put them in there, which are all about the woman, but they don't then think, well, what about the care provider? Because they say that that doesn't impact it at all, but actually it has more of an impact than any of those other factors. Because absolutely, a woman who's had a baby stuck, in the most basic term, like if they had a baby that hasn't come through the pelvis, right, in the previous one, and they had a cesarean, if they're older, if they're fatter, if they're Black or Hispanic, they absolutely can have a VBAC in the right care, especially if they're able to get the right care for them. And so if they're Black, that's with Black midwives, right? If they are in continuity of care with a midwife to who really understands them, and they're birthing in the location that they feel safe for them, then that VBAC calculator kind of goes out the window.
Ugh. So can you share your analogy, your Olympic
analogy? Oh, sure.
Because that's what that makes me think of.
Well, we've had another Olympics since then, haven't we? Because when I wrote that one, that was thinking of the Tokyo Olympics. Mm-hmm. So there was, I don't know if you remember the meme at the time, way back at the Tokyo Olympics, and there was the swimming race going on, and quickly the cameras deviated from the swimming race up to the audience, because there was a coach who was like so happy. Like this person was like, woo, 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 woo. And I never know if that person actually, or if the swimmer actually won their race. It didn't matter, because that coach was just so happy and so invested that person had got to the Olympics and were being given the opportunity to do their best. And that best may mean you get through to the heats, and may mean you get a gold, but it also means you can get your personal best, and that you've had every opportunity to get there. And when I saw that video and all the hype that was online at the time about it, I just thought, well, there's women, right, who access our maternity care far more often than they would ever go to the Olympics. And they need to look at their team around them. And that team around them is going to influence whether or not they feel great after their birthing experience. Now, that's different from the mode of birth you get, but it's about those four factors that I talked about. So it's whether or not you feel satisfied, good, great, any of the positives after your next birth after cesarean. And the reason the team is so important, because the analogy is, you know, imagine you're getting ready for that swimming race, and you think you're going to get selected, but your coach has just retired, and then you've got to go and interview some more coaches. And the first coach you go to is like, oh, I really don't think, I don't like your chances. Like, you're just not the right body shape. There's something about you, and people from your background, they don't do this type of swimming. Like, that's not normal for you. I really just think you'd be better being on the sidelines and supporting someone else. Like, I don't think this race is for you, even though it might be what they've been trying to do and wanting to do from being a child. And then they go to a different coach and that coach says, you know what? I think you can do this because you believe that you can do this. And I want to be there every step of the way. I'm going to be there to get you the best physio. I'm going to be there to get you the best nutritionist, the best massage therapist. I've got a whole team around you that are going to make sure that you get your personal best. And whatever you get at the end, I'm going to be there cheering you along like that person in the Tokyo Olympics. I completely want to dedicate this time to you to get the best birth for you. Now, I know which one I'd rather go to. I'd rather go to that individual rather than the person that doesn't even believe I can make it through the race, let alone, you know, want to support me do that. So I think we need to get the power back into women's hands so that when they actually are choosing their team and using that language of the team means that this team is coming to work with me. I'm not just lucky to get a spot with this particular person. I'm choosing the team. And now I see it. We've got a great Facebook group, a support group in Australia. It's massive now. And I hear women say, I'm looking at choosing my team, or I've chosen the best team. And I'm like, yay, now the power goes back to the woman rather than losing the power and just being a patient of X, Y, and Z. And that's, I think,
what that's so good.
Get to. And actually what I throw out to clinicians then, and I say this in the second book, is you need to deserve a spot on that team. You shouldn't just get to be on that team and not do any of the work and not do any of the boosting up. Like, you can't just be a boring member of that team or a negative member of that team, because if you are, you don't deserve a spot. You've got to make yourself to be deserving of that spot. You want to be the one on social media and they're saying, you want this person on your team. Like, that should be you.
That's so good. That.
And women of strength, as you're listening, I felt a difference in my body. Just as Hazel, you were talking about the first, I imagine myself as the woman going to you as my provider and hearing, well, I'm not sure, because I sat in appointments just like that. I went for a VBAC twice. I have four kids. I went for a VBAC two times. And then with my third, I ended up doing a scheduled maternal assisted cesarean, or my fourth, I'm sorry. Anyway, but I've had experiences with providers where I've felt the skepticism and I've felt that, yes, we're on your team. Do you want that experience? You want that? Let's make it happen for you. Even though Absolutely. It was something new, it was the first MAC that they'd ever done in South Korea. And it's amazing to see. And also something that I love in your book that you said was people should not be offended when physiological birth is the goal. We shouldn't. And when I was looking for someone who would be open to the idea of maternal assisted cesarean, I mean, I didn't even know for sure. Maybe I wanted to try for a VBAC again, but I knew that I wanted to find somebody who would support VBAC too. And it was presented. The option was presented to me too. So I know sometimes CBAC moms, cesarean moms, it can be a sensitive subject, but it really also kind of shouldn't be, because if clinicians allow physiological birth to happen, then you can pivot. Then you can make better experiences for any type of birth. And totally. That's also what I love that you focus on. And you're very inclusive. As a CBAC mom, I felt so seen and heard. And the way that your chapter titles were just BAC, birth after cesarean, it's for everyone. It was so inclusive. And so I just appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's so exciting that you had a maternal assisted cesarean, which is what you wanted for you to have your better birth. And when I went into my PhD, I did think it was all about the vagina, because I'd had a VBAC and I'd looked at women's experiences of how to VBAC at home. That was my first study. But if you're going to be a researcher, you've got to be open to change as well, right? Because you've got to be someone who can be reflective and go, well, also as a feminist researcher, you've got to be able to go, well, these are my views and my opinions and I want to put them aside. But for me, actually, it's like, well, these are my views and my opinions and my experiences. And I want to know if I'm going to be changed, because I'm open to it. I'm excited to learn what is out there. Mm-hmm. And during my PhD, that's exactly what I found, because, you know, in that qualitative time when I was following women throughout their whole pregnancy and then I interviewed them all afterwards, and I all did individual recordings on a little app during the whole pregnancy. And there were women who, there were half of the cohort who had a VBAC, half who had a repeat cesarean, and one who had a forceps in theatre. And I didn't find what I was maybe expecting was that all the VBAC mums were happy and all the cesarean mums were devastated. Now, I will say all the VBAC mums were happy, but that's just, I had a small sample, right? Because this was the cold side. But actually, some of the cesarean mums were happy too. You know, they were really happy that their choices got heard during the cesarean. Yeah. Like they were able to, whatever they asked for, they were able to get. And it wasn't as traumatic as their previous one. And they had a better birth after cesarean. I'm like, I was really happy to be changed by that and go, yeah, all right, now I know this is actually about how women are treated, how much control they have over the whole decision, about the relationship, and the option for choice. And that really came out in the active labor thing for women who planned to be back and had a repeat emergency, because they had the option to be active in labor was really important as well. And it's about having those choices. So your choice of wanting a maternal assisted cesarean, having the choice of a VBAC if that was what you want to do, but also this was maternal cesarean and you had full control over what was going to happen, right? Because you said, these are the things I want to happen. This is what a maternal assisted cesarean is. And they supported you. So you had a good trust and a good relationship with your healthcare provider. No wonder you felt great and amazing after that, because you scored across all those four factors. And on the same side, you can have women who've experienced, who don't feel great after a VBAC. And I think that's, it seems sometimes, should we talk about that? But I published the first paper with the research team on obstetric violence in Australia. And in some of those themes were experiences of assault. And some of those assault were during vaginal examinations. So I know as a test case, right, like there could be a woman planning a VBAC who then feels that she was violated during her VBAC experience and is now meant to be really, really happy. How can you be happy when you've experienced obstetric violence, which does the utmost in wrecking you? Right, because it makes you dehumanized, powerless, and violated. Those were the three themes that came out of it. So on the same point, it's more about how can we give women trauma-informed, respectful maternity care, and that's where those four factors really work, then we will have much happier women, and therefore they're going into motherhood, which is the most important job in the world, stronger and more powerful.
Taking a quick break from our episode to share this important stat with you. Did you know a 2025 retrospective cohort study published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that doula care was associated with about a 15.6 increase in VBAC rates compared to those without doula support? Lily and I love doulas, and we are doulas. The VBAC Link was founded by doulas Julie Frankham and Megan Heaton, who created a comprehensive VBAC course for doulas. It's fully self-paced, completely virtual, and when you complete it, you're added to the VBAC Link doula directory. You'll also earn 8 ICEA continuing education hours and become a VBAC certified doula. And if you're a parent looking for a VBAC Link certified doula, you can find one at thevbaclink.com/findadoula. All right, let's get back to the episode.
But you're right on the other thing. You mentioned about the challenging part of women not wanting us to talk about the importance of vaginal birth as well. In my PhD in the survey, which I didn't release that data until I did the second book, we actually asked a question, why plan a VBAC? And the most common comments that came out was about experiencing vaginal birth. Women really wanted to experience that and have the opportunity to experience that. And we certainly see that as an importance, a high importance scale when we look at that in our national study as well, which is now international. So it does make us feel, should we? Because we don't want anyone to feel bad, right? We don't want women that have chosen cesareans to feel that they're less of a woman or less of a mother or whatever. But the flip side of that is that we can end up normalizing surgical birth, right? We can end up normalizing major abdominal surgery with its many, many risk factors, although in most of our high-income countries are pretty low still, rather than something that the bodies actually were designed for. Like physiological birth is something that for many, many women, if we give them the space and the opportunity and the support, will have a vaginal birth. And I think if we normalize surgical birth, then we may be silencing women that actually want to experience vaginal birth. And again, this really comes out in VBAC.
Yeah, I think that's such a tough thing. And we see it even in, we made a dive this year into TikTok.
Oh, wow.
People are not as kind on TikTok as Instagram, because like the algorithm just puts you in front of people. And so they're like, oh, you're talking about C-sections. Like, let's put you in front of C-section moms. And we got a lot of like, well, you can't be proud of having a VBAC because that then shames moms that had cesareans. And so it's this like this dynamic of how do you have these values of like, I really wanted to experience vaginal delivery. My personal experience with my son was that I labored and I didn't feel like I delivered my C-section baby because it was like a hard stop to that whole process. And I felt very disconnected and it was a source of a lot of my trauma. Whereas my daughter, like my hands were the first hands that ever touched her and like brought her into the world, mine and my husband together with our incredible midwife who just hands off, she's the best. And so I just think that it matters. The feelings behind our desires to VBAC matter. And just today in our Q&A, someone was like, well, what are the benefits of VBAC or not VBAC of TOLAC if it doesn't end in a repeat cesarean, if it does end in a repeat cesarean? And you end up in this flip side of like, were there benefits to having a labor? Because often you're told, well, that's the riskiest part. And there was a lot of really great conversation in our community just today about like, well, you're getting some great hormones. You're getting the experience of the labor. Like maybe you really wanted to experience labor and you got to do that. Like that is so powerful. And at the end of the day, like you get to be in the driver's seat of deciding where your values are and you're allowed to have them, which I just think is so powerful to hear.
Yeah, it is so important. And at the end of the day is that what the woman wanted? Like if she was planning that, if she wants to plan a vaginal birth, then we should be 100% supportive of that. It's like, absolutely. And then making the environment fit that, because often what happens is women go, yep, I'd like to plan a VBAC. And then they've got a birth in a very restrictive environment, with very restrictive policies that say you can't get off the bed, or you've got to have these cannulas in, or you're going to have to be induced, or you have to be on a CTG. Now, all of these may have good reasons. However, if a woman says, I don't want to do that, which then there should be just, you know, an acceptance of that, it might not be a great supportive environment for them. And it's knowing. Well, the one thing we often miss out on, I think, in the hospital system for VBAC, which in the home and birthing center they get because of the location, is setting up the woman for, you know, I don't like the term success, but that's the term, right? Success. Well, setting up the woman to have the best experience for her. And if she's planning a VBAC, it's actually take out the AC. We know it's after cesarean. She knows all about the uterine rupture risks and all that kind of stuff. Now she wants a vaginal birth. So what can we do to promote vaginal birth in that setting? And it's not treating her as something that's about to explode like a bomb.
Totally.
It's actually treating her like a real woman who's going to do real things, who needs to move and do all the things that she needs to do and doesn't need to have things attached to her to be able to do all that. And we often have a relapse at that point. People are just like, no, but she's planning a VBAC, so we must do all these things to her and don't you dare move and don't you do that. And like, how on earth can you have a vaginal birth in that environment? You may as well just say, we support a cesarean before labor or a cesarean during labor, because we're not actually going to give you the chance to be as active as you can be with the people around you without feeling like, you know, even going to a woman after every contraction and saying, are you getting any scar pain? Oh, is that pain different from the last one? Like, seriously, I've had women say that to
me. They're not thinking about it. They are now.
Yeah. Like, come on. As midwife, surely you know the role of oxytocin and you know the role of adrenaline. Why are you pumping adrenaline in the room?
Yeah, I know. I feel so grateful. I had a hospital water birth, actually. So our hospital is like really embracing this idea of low intervention birth. And I just felt like, gosh, I didn't miss out on anything. I had originally planned to be at a birth center, and affordability wise, it wasn't an option for us. And it was like so redemptive to like, I got to use the yoga sling and I got to be in the water. And there was nobody telling me. I had such a great midwife who went to bat for me, who was like, listen, she's not getting an IV. She's not doing continuous monitoring. Like, these are the things. And we've talked about it. So you don't need to talk about it with her. Like, we're good. We're good. And it was so fantastic. I ended up doing IVs, but I had them pull them every time. Like, they were so supportive. And I think that it can make people nervous. But now as a doula watching that hospital do more and more low intervention birth, there's just like, they've gotten into this groove and this vibe. And so think of it, just
that's
takes
what we need to
yes, like, come on, let's do it. Let's do it together, because it really is. It's changing lives for sure.
I had an obstetrician in one of my workshops once about, I think he was a year or two ago. And there was lots of questions about, what about VBAC after two cesareans, three cesareans? What about this one? And he just turned around and he went, but none of that's going to change the way that I care for her. Like, he would say, if she's in hospital because she's under my care, because he's a private obstetrician, so she's already in hospital and she's going to have monitoring, whether that's intermittent or continuous. And if there are signs of distress in either the woman or the baby, we'll go for a cesarean. Like, that's not going to change with these added layers or added extra issues. He said, so I think and he was just getting back into VBAC. He's like, I think I will support that because I can't see how what I would do would change what she wants to do. If she's planning, you know, if she's planning to birth with him in the hospital. I mean, water birth is one that I'm quite well known for scathing professionals that won't support VBAC water birth. Cause you know, honestly, go find me the research that says you can't do that or that it's dangerous. Cause there isn't any, don't bother wasting your time. You're way too busy, but there isn't anything that says you cannot have, or you shouldn't have a VBAC in the water because it's dangerous for the woman or the baby. Cause there just isn't. And I was at a conference recently and they were doing their consumer group. I love this consumer group. This consumer group were doing a fundraiser for their consumer group. And there was myself, another keynote, who's an amazing human rights in childbirth lawyer and organizer. We got t-shirts made in our honor with quotes from us. And mine said, it's just a bath. Actually, the real quote did have a swear word. Before bath, because I know. But they didn't put that on a t-shirt. But it says,
That is so cool.
I love it.
And they just a bath. And they sent me, I bought one of each when I was there. I was like, I've got to have my friends' names on me. But yeah, they sent me one as well. And I love that because they're like, I'm going to wear this to my work and I'm going to give this to the doctor. And I'm like, yeah, do it. Because it's just a bath. And until you start getting consent every single time you have a bath at home, then what's the worry? You're not even putting anything in there. Like, you can't, it just doesn't make any sense. And as a midwife, I love the fact that a water birth gives 100% control to the woman, because we can't really do things to you without your consent, right? Because we can't be touching places that we shouldn't be touching, inserting fingers into places we shouldn't be doing when you're in the water. Because you just move away, right? You're like, just go away. they can't get you. And that, what I have seen come out of research is about that circle of security that a water birth gives you. And that's exactly why I think some clinicians don't like it, because they lose control.
That's real.
And they have to pass that on to the woman and trust her. That was one of the other t-shirts, just trust women. That was my lovely friend Claire that said that one, we must trust women. But that's something really hard for some clinicians who want to hold all the control. Therefore, why do you think the lithotomy position came about in the first place? It wasn't by midwives. It was when the male doctors started to get involved in birth and they wanted to see everything because, well, they obviously don't know much about women's private parts, do they? So they needed to watch stuff and be at a level that they can just get in there and do stuff. And then they separated it from the woman by a big screen. So no one else could know what's going on. And that, you know, there were butchers back then when they first started. Literally, that was their profession, to get babies out. But as they became more refined, the control didn't change. And mm-hmm. the control stayed in the person who was at that end with the woman flat on her back, legs in stirrups, and they've got full control. And I think why some people don't like water birth is it flips that. The control mm-hmm. completely goes back to the woman, and that's where it should only ever be in my book.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and going back, it's like, it's so simple, but then also it becomes so complicated, but it's like, just take it back to the woman, just trust her. So I did want to ask you one question though.
Yeah.
You said you were interviewing. So in like one section of your book, you interview different providers with the same questions. And I wanted to know your response to one of these questions. And it was, if you have had a poor outcome of the mother or baby following a birth after cesarean, how did you cope with that and continue to support future women's birthing choices? Because that's hard. That's the weight that providers carry.
That was a big question for me to put in there for them, wasn't it? And I put that in there to kind of get, you know, this is written for clinicians, to get clinicians to really understand that it does have an impact. You know, we think that we'll see something and then just, you know, one shot washes off our back and we go back into the next room. But I wanted them to think about that it actually does have an impact. I have seen outcomes that are not great. And I think the one that I had the biggest influence on me was where I had the honor to be a midwife for a woman. I've been a midwife for all of her births at this point. And then I turn up to baby number three at home, and it's really exciting. And she's had a really short labor and then a really long labor. And so who knows what number three is going to be. And she was like, don't come yet. But I like wolfed my breakfast down and was there like in 15 minutes. And I went to listen to the baby's heartbeat and there wasn't one. But as soon as I had arrived, she went into transition because, you know, we've got that trust. And she's like, oh, Hazel's here. And body just goes, oh, let's get this baby out. And so I had very little time to ascertain that. And it was big. Like it was the baby had passed the day before or maybe overnight. Didn't look like it just happened. And that was a big journey to go on. It was obviously devastating for the woman and her partner and her kids that were at home for the home birth, to suddenly have ambulances and, you know, all the stuff that goes with it and the emotion. But they kept me in that, like I stayed on that journey with them that was more than just the birth. It was lots and lots of support and appointments at home, and it was going through the notes many months later, like the hospital notes with her and all the results that they had done at the time, or the tests that they had done at the time. And then that was supporting her. And at this point, I was a full-time academic. So I was no longer practicing as a clinician, as a midwife. So I could only, and I told her, she knew this, she knew when I gave up my insurance, I asked permission from her, can I give up my insurance? And she chose to have me as her support person for her next pregnancy as well. And that was huge. And I, you know, we stayed in contact and we still stay in contact. And her beautiful baby would have been seven this month. So, yeah, that was huge. But the next day, I went and supported a woman having a VBAC at home who had lots of risk factors, but this was her choice. And I had to kind of go, like, but every woman's experience is different, and she deserves, and what I say to my students is that every woman deserves respectful maternity care. And I had to just not bring those fears into the next birth. But I was able to look back and go, I don't think it changed my practice, but it made me be really, I guess, really, really honor the role of continuity of care and how important that is, and the relationship-based care that can happen, because I learned so much through that relationship with her, through the horrible moment that it happened, all the way through to supporting the next baby being born alive. and seeing her family grow, like that's because I think I saw that length and I saw her grow and I saw her family change and never forget their baby, but grow around their baby. That I think made me really respect the importance of relationship-based care, especially one that is led by the woman, that she makes the choices and the options. And there's nothing that could have happened differently in that scenario. It was just one of those things, you never know why. But it was such an honor to be a witness and a support person during that time. Yeah, and there's others that make you think, oh, did I make the right decision at the time, like to transfer in or not? And, you know, there's sometimes there's women are like, oh, they it might not sit well with them, but you can only use your knowledge and your skills at that point. And I was a home birth midwife for many years. I never think a transfer in is never a bad transfer. It's a transfer for a reason. And that reason was evident at the time, whatever that reason was. And even if it wasn't that in the end, or maybe it was preventing that in the future. So, yeah, I think we just have to go, okay, that was that. But the way that I think as midwives that we have to work on is talking about it and being honest about it. And I actually had a really beautiful moment just last weekend, was it? When I was at the workshop in Perth. And one of the stories in the book is the beautiful doula, Vicky Hobbs. I don't know if you remember her story. And she's a doula. And she talked about two women that she cared for, one who lost a baby and one who had a VBAC and had a very triumphant VBAC. Both had VBACs. And in that room of people that she knows, because she had trained many of the doulas there, I got them all to read her story. And then we had a Q&A session on it. Well, more of a reflection session with Vicky right there. And we were able to, and I facilitated that reflection session, and it was really deep and it was really beautiful. And I had people there that were just about to start their doula training all the way up to 30 years of being a midwife in the room. This is how the experience that I had. And the biggest conversation was exactly what you asked me. How did you cope after that birth where the baby passed away? And I loved that Vicky actually talked about getting help. She talked about going to see a counselor and what the advice was at that point. And I just thought, well, that can't be a better lesson than that, because everybody in this room, we're normalizing getting help. We're normalizing vicarious trauma. We're normalizing that we're human. And she has been able to go on and support other women because she did the work. And she talked about what suggestions she was given by her counselor and what she did for the work. And I am starting to say to clinicians now, and I do say in the second book, you've got to do the work. Like if you're taking on this kind of experience, and sometimes they're fantastic and sometimes they're terrible, you've got to do the work to get yourself sorted out so that you can be the best person for the next woman, because they don't need to know that you're broken. That will impact their birth, and you may then impact their choices. And that's not okay. Our first standard of practice in midwifery in Australia is to provide safe, evidence-based midwifery care. So if you let your fears and your experiences change that, so you're now only suggesting one type of birth rather than the other, then you're not even working to your very first standard of practice. Mm-hmm. So do the work. We've got 24-hour helplines here in Australia called the Nurse and Midwife Support Line. You know, most hospitals have got support, you know, have got counselling services. Universities have counselling services. Reach out and get them so that you can be the best version of you, because you deserve that spot on the team.
So true. Well, thank you so much, Hazel.
I know, I'm inspired. Lily and I are both doulas. We're kind of on the newer end of that. And I know that I'm so inspired from hearing you and just your mentorship. Is there anything else before we close out that you want our listeners to know?
Well, I will just have a shout out to all those that contributed to the second book. Like I put my own reflection in there and that was very vulnerable. But then to ask other people to put their reflections in, and some of them are really very, very personal journeys. Mm-hmm. And I thank them for doing that. And especially the group of midwives from Indonesia that just wrote their stories as well. And the team that translated that for me. I write my books, but I never write them alone. There's always other people and other reflections and other stories in there. So Kirsten Small for her bit on CTGs and VBAC. So yeah, it is a combination of stories, and I'm proud of that because it takes many different ideas and many different thoughts to connect to the many different clinicians and the many different women out there.
Yeah.
Well, great. So everybody, Women of Strength, run. And if you haven't read Hazel's first book, go get that one. And then if you haven't given your provider her second one, go do that and read it yourself, A Clinician's Guide to Better Birth After Cesarean. I just got it on Amazon, so it's there. And thank you. Thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for joining us today and the conversations. I hope it's not our last. We think the world of you, and I could talk so much more about lots of other things too. I had a whole list, and I feel like we just scratched the surface, yet also got very deep too. So I was telling Dr. Keetle that I'm going to Australia for the first time next month. So I will be thinking of you, and I won't be where you are, but I'll be waving.
Well, have a wonderful time. Australia is such a beautiful country wherever you visit. You know, whether you're visiting the tropics, the desert, which you are kind of coming, or down here into the cities and the forests, then one thing we've got is a lot of beauty and a lot of love and a lot of friendly people. So I hope you have a wonderful time.
Well, thank you so much. And if you ever find yourself in South Korea
or Colorado,
look me up, or Colorado.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much again.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Keetle.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode and for being a part of our community. One of my favorite parts of the VBAC Link is the community itself. When I was pregnant and planning for a VBA 2C, the VBAC Link community group on Facebook truly became a virtual village for me. It's where I could see real VBAC stories, ask questions without judgment, and get encouragement from people who genuinely understood what I was preparing for. If you are planning a VBAC and want support as you get ready, head over to Facebook and search the VBAC Link community, because women of strength become even stronger together.